Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
So when the storm hits, you've got to get the tarp there on the woodpile. Ben, Bernanke, grab a corner now.
To be sure, there are many challenges associated with the design and implementation of the tarp, including determining which assets will be purchased and how prices will be determined.
The Fed chief grabs the TARP, that's the Troubled Asset Relief Program, and throws it over the troubled markets. But it may be back to the woodshed as global markets sell off again. Gentle Ben was a bear, right? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, October 8th. So, John, is it fair to say that we're foraging in the black forest of the economy?
Oh, oh. Good morning, Adora. Good morning.
Okay, on a serious note, we're going to take a look at last night's presidential debate. And, of course, we are also watching the struggling markets both here and overseas. And a new story today on a yet-to-be-released military report that says a U.S. airstrike in Afghanistan last summer killed more civilians than the military originally said. And how do you say don't panic in Klingon? John's going to tell you.
First, these headlines. The Fed and other central banks around the world are throwing the switch to stabilize the tanking markets. The Federal Reserve ordered an emergency interest rate cut of half a point to 1.5% on the Fed funds rate. The move appears to have worked. European markets are rallying after significant drops before the announcement. The Dow futures are up more than 100 points. John McCain and Barack Obama want President Bush's job. That we know. But it's not an easy gig. These days, President Bush has the difficult task of talking up the economy.
This isn't the first time the American economy has faced challenges, and it's not going to be the first time that we haven't recovered and come out better either.
No sign of recovery in Asian markets today. The Nikkei went into a free fall, 9.4% drop, biggest plunge in 21 years. Indonesia's market halted trading.
John McCain and Barack Obama's campaigns completely agree about last night's debate in Tennessee. They both say their guy won. We'll get real analysis of the debate coming up with Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein. Yesterday on Capitol Hill, it was the insurance firm AIG's turn to get flogged as the House investigates how we got into the current financial mess. Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney attacked two former CEOs for ignoring warning signs, she says, and dealing in risky financial schemes.
You were just gambling billions, possibly trillions of dollars.
U.S. taxpayers had to step in with an $85 billion rescue package for AIG, so lawmakers were steamed that days after getting the dough, AIG execs spent nearly $500,000 on a luxury spa retreat. Russian forces are wrapping up their final pullout from Georgia's South Ossetia region. They say they'll be fully out of the separatist buffer zone by Thursday.
Just under a month until Election Day, John McCain and Sarah Palin are in Ohio and Pennsylvania. Barack Obama campaigns in Indiana today.
Oil prices below $87 a barrel in Asian trading. As we said, the futures are poised for a positive opening on Wall Street in about an hour and a half. And the word is, don't panic. How do you say it? Economists are urging markets not to panic, but there are actually at least 42 ways, 42 languages of saying the words don't panic.
So how are you keeping yourself calm? What's the argument you use on yourself, on your friends, on your family? We want to hear how you are dealing with what could be anxious times. 8778, my take.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. We have some news on the economy this morning. The Federal Reserve has cut its key interest rate, cut it a half point to 1.5%. European and Chinese banks, they followed suit quickly, and the markets there are rallying, at least in Europe. More on that story is coming up. But first, we're going to take a look at the presidential debate that took place last night between John McCain and Barack Obama in Nashville, Tennessee. It was a different format with a small group of voters asking questions and sitting quietly as they spoke. Joining us now from Nashville is Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein.
Good morning from rainy Nashville.
Rainy Nashville. Now, you say the big question floating around yesterday was whether or not the debate would really turn into a slugfest. How did it all play out?
You know, I really liked this debate. It's my favorite of the three. And strangely, even though the format was clearly scripted, all these people had been handpicked, they were very restricted in the way they could ask the questions and their inability to do follow-up. And you could see from where we were in the media center, you could see on the monitors that behind this small crowd around the candidates was a huge audience of people watching. So it looked like they were watching a stage production. Even with all that, having the real people on the stage seemed to ground the candidates. It seemed to bring them back to a moment in the campaign, perhaps in Iowa, perhaps in New Hampshire, where they were discussing policy differences, where they were trying to make human connections. And mostly what we got was a serious discussion about the issues. When they started off, McCain, I mean, he's facing an increasingly hostile electoral map. It looks like some states like North Carolina, Indiana, where it was yesterday, are becoming tied for him, not red. So it was a question of whether he was going to go nuclear. But instead, right out of the bat, he starts off with a new policy proposal to bail out homeowners by buying back their bad loans from the banks with $300 billion of federal money. Here's what he said.
Is it expensive? Yes. But we all know, my friends, until we stabilize home values in America, we're never going to start turning around and creating jobs and fixing our economy. And we've got to give some trust and confidence back to America. I know how to do that, my friends. And it's my proposal. It's not Senator Obama's proposal. It's not President Bush's proposal.
And, Andrew, an interesting proposal at that, a real turnaround, it would seem, for a Republican candidate proposing a $300 billion bailout for homeowners as opposed to letting the market run.
Yeah, really a sharp turn. And last March, McCain was pilloried for saying homeowners should not be protected from their own bad judgment. But last night, he really needed something to tell voters that he had a plan to get them out of their pain. Now, Obama came back with his own big plan. He wants a sort of New Deal-style Works Progress Administration plan, which he said would create construction jobs and put people back to work. And he said to McCain, you know, it's not just about keeping people in their homes, it's about income. But then he did, about half an hour into the debate, his own role reversal by raising 9/11.
A lot of you remember the tragedy of 9/11 and where you were on that day, and you know how all of the country was ready to come together and make enormous changes to make us not only safer but to make us a better country and a more unified country. And you know, President Bush did some smart things at the outset, but one of the opportunities that was missed was when he spoke to the American people, he said, go out and shop.
It was interesting because, Andrew, you and I were actually blogging online with some of our listeners, and people immediately were stunned that a Democrat brought up 9/11.
Yeah, that's right. Although I think what Obama was trying to do was sort of transport people to this sense when people felt unified and together. Remember, 90% of the people supported the president right after 9/11. Just a little more than 20% do now. But he was also really trying to make an argument. Everybody's going to have to sacrifice. Everybody's going to have to face some tough times. And we're going to have to be all in it together. He made the point that a teacher making $35,000 doesn't get why she should sacrifice when people making much more are living high on the hog. And he particularly mentioned this AIG spa treatment junket. But really, a lot of the debate was about arguing about policy differences, like when McCain accused Obama of wanting to raise taxes.
Nailing down Senator Obama's various tax proposals is like nailing Jell-O to the wall. There's been five or six of them, and if you wait long enough, there'll probably be another one. But he wants to raise taxes. My friends, the last president to raise taxes during tough economic times was Herbert Hoover.
And Andrea, this is really a movement where Obama responded very swiftly, which seemed to be a strong theme throughout the debate.
Yeah, he came right back and he said 95% of Americans will have lower taxes. And then he threw back at McCain that he wants to give a $300 billion tax cut to corporations. It's interesting because out on the trail, voters do respond to the charge that Obama will raise taxes. That gets their attention. But that seems to be replaced by the charge that Obama is making that McCain wants to lower corporate taxes. I'm hearing a lot of less of he's going to raise my taxes and a lot more he's going to cut theirs.
There's an energy bill on the floor of the Senate loaded down with goodies, billions for the oil companies. And it was sponsored by Bush and Cheney. You know who voted for it? You might never know that one. You know who voted against it? Me. I have fought time after time against these pork barrel, these bills that come to the floor, and they have all kinds of goodies and all kinds of things in them for everybody, and they buy off the votes. I vote against them, my friends. I vote against them.
I wonder, Andrea, if McCain's answer was lost because some people seem to get stuck on two words in there, which was that one when McCain was responding or referring to Obama.
That's right. And the Obama campaign didn't want us to miss it. During the debate, Bill Burton, Obama's spokesman, sent out an email with the subject line question. And he said, did McCain just call Obama that one? And when we were on our blog, listeners reacted extremely negatively. They thought that was dismissive. They thought it was rude. It obviously displayed some contempt. Although there clearly is a point that McCain was trying to make, which is that you might be surprised if you looked at some of these things, how people voted on these issues. Obama sort of, you know, came back. I mean, he didn't give a real clear, strong answer to the energy bill, but then he came back with this sort of really moving moment when the candidates began to talk about health care, which was a big thing, about his mother dying in the hospital. And this got an off-the-charts reaction if you look at some of the people meters, especially from women.
I think it should be a right for every American. In a country as wealthy as ours, for us to have people who are going bankrupt because they can't pay their medical bills. For my mother to die of cancer at the age of 53 and have to spend the last months of her life in a hospital room arguing with insurance companies because they're saying that this may be a pre-existing condition and they don't have to pay her treatment, there's something fundamentally wrong about that.
You know, it felt like oratory from Obama, I think, followed by specifics from McCain. It was an interesting sort of point-counterpoint in this debate, and I think that's what made it really engaging.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that both of them gave really a lot more details than I've seen them give in a long time. And it was interesting that there was so much time that they spent dwelling on health care. And then in the spin room afterwards, it was a big subject with both campaigns coming out and the Obama campaign trying to say that McCain's health care plan is a tax hike because it would cut the tax exemption for employers to offer it, instead sort of make an across-the-board one. And the McCain people pushing back and saying, look, ours would give every individual $2,500, every family $5,000, not really answering the question about whether that's enough. But it's interesting that out in the spin room, they were going back and forth on this policy issue of health care, which has become so important for voters because it's one of the main ways that people feel that their economic situation is not improving because they're having trouble paying for health insurance and health care.
And just another thought on the format itself, Andrea. It was very different in that this was an opportunity to see each of them moving around, and there were certain impressions that people seemed to get from their body language. Was that talked about after the debate?
Well, you know, not so much, although I do think that both candidates were able to make a connection. And I think that that is one of the big themes that they're going to be trying to do for the next slightly less than 4 weeks is to connect with voters on a personal level. And we heard that in Indiana, you know, how are they going to help me? And, you know, McCain sort of going right up to people, talking to them, saying to one veteran, thank you for your service, which is a line I've heard him probably say 1,000 times. But having them roam around in a crowd cut down on the posturing. Mm-hmm. And I think that that, in the end, gave voters a lot more of what they wanted to hear from both of them.
Andrea Bernstein, many thanks as always.
Thank you.
Andrea Bernstein, a Takeaway's political director, reporting from Tennessee.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hi, I'm calling about the don't panic question. George Washington's troops were about to starve. He did not panic. Our country is formed on not panicking.
There are some words of wisdom. We're wondering how you are handling the headlines, the constant, seemingly constantly bad headlines about the economy. How are you not panicking? What advice do you have to America about not panicking? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
How do you say don't panic? There are 42 ways. You don't even have to do it in English. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. This morning, the U.S. Federal Reserve cut a key interest rate by 0.5 percentage point. The move was in coordination with global central banks. The Bank of England cut its rate by 0.5 point to 4.5%. European Central Bank sliced its rate to 3.75%. Also, China joined the party. Markets have rallied in Europe. This comes after stock markets around the world dropped sharply. In afternoon trading, Japan's benchmark Nikkei index fell by more than 9% at one point. And if that weren't enough, the news from London this morning that extraordinary steps have been taken by the British government to step into the banking crisis there. Back with us is BBC business correspondent Alex Ritson. First of all, Alex, let's talk about this coordinated interest rate cut. That's an unusual move right off the top.
John, unusual, unprecedented, I think is the word. Just extraordinary. Six central banks, the Bank of England, the US Fed, the ECB, and then the central banks of Canada, Sweden and Switzerland, all at once at exactly the same time cutting their key interest rates by 0.5%. China also joined the party, cutting its rate by about 0.25%. I think the extraordinary thing here is not the fact that they've cut interest rates, because some people think that's a good idea, some people don't. It's the fact that they've all done it at the same time. You know, in the last few days, we've heard a lot of people saying that the real problem here is that none of the big financial institutions, the governments around the world, seem to be able to present a united front, have a coherent plan to deal with the global financial crisis. What they've done here is turn around and say, we're going to act together, we're going to coordinate, and we're going to act together to take this crisis on and sort it out.
And you're seeing a rally both in Europe and in the futures as we are about 1 hour and 5 minutes away from the open on Wall Street. It does seem as though what looks like coordinated activity in the United States is being mirrored or matched by coordinated activity in these central banks around the world, and that may be the only thing that's really reassuring here.
I think you've got it exactly right there, John. It's not the fact that it's an interest rate cut. You know, that's nice, but it's only 0.5%. There's division over whether that's what's needed. What people are pleased about, what investors will be pleased to see, is that there is finally some coordination, that the central banks of the world are acting together and showing some leadership, trying to sort this problem out.
So in other words, would you describe this as a big, dramatic gesture, as John sometimes talks about, really to inspire some confidence that someone at the top, there's a captain on the ship?
Absolutely, Adora. You're completely right. What this is saying is that finally they're talking to each other. Maybe they are sorting out ways to solve this problem together, because the piecemeal approach, which has been tried by pretty much every country that's been affected by this crisis, quite clearly hasn't been working.
Give us some details on the intervention by the British government into the banking sector. The big five or six banks there in London all of a sudden have $87 billion from the UK Treasury. That's unprecedented, too.
Absolutely unprecedented. This is a three-step plan. There's $87 billion, which is available as an investment should they need it, because the share prices of these banks has just fallen through the floor in recent days, and some of these banks have really, really suffered. RBS is a good example. It's a huge name on the British high street. Not only owns its own name, but also owns another British bank with a tremendous history called NatWest. RBS has seen its share price really tank. It dropped 20%. On Monday. It dropped 40% yesterday. Finally, there's this coordinated plan by the British government that the share price of RBS has actually recovered by some 23%. And then shares in HFOS, another bank that was really on the ropes. If you'd bought shares in that yesterday, well, you'd be laughing today. The shares in HFOS have jumped by some 60%. But, you know, again, wow. What's happening here? Yeah, 60%. It's just extraordinary. Other banks have seen their share prices falling by a bit, 5 or 10% initially. They have pulled back a bit since the details of the interest rate cut. But again, it's the fact that there's a plan. The government is saying we're not going to let our banks go to the wall in this crisis. We're going to take action. We're going to sort it out. Can I just quickly say also on top of that, the government has also made available £200 billion, $350 billion to the banks to cover short-term operations, liquidity, the day-to-day working capital for banks, and another £250 million, that's almost $500 billion, is there as guarantees on the loans that banks make to each other. So they've no excuse not to lend to each other anymore. The money is there.
All right. One last detail. The AP is reporting that in Hong Kong, which used to be very much in the sort of Commonwealth financial sector, not anymore, but there are thousands of people protesting in Hong Kong who want their money out of Lehman Brothers operations, which were suspended when the bank went bankrupt. So not everyone is reassured at this moment. Alex Ritson, one last question. How do you say don't panic?
I speak only English, and I'm not going to tell anyone not to panic. I'm just going to say watch this space and be careful. You've got to keep your head if you're an investor. You mustn't panic if you're an investor, but you still have to be careful.
Alex Ritson, if panicking is a smart idea, he's going for it. Alex Ritson, BBC Business correspondent, on the line with us from London, and now headlines from Richard Hake.
And John, now 28 minutes past the top of the hour, the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, Sweden, and China joining the U.S. in its coordinated series of interest rate cuts. The Federal Reserve just announced that it's cutting the key interest rate by a half a point. The emergency cut brings it to 1.5%. The recent financial instability is hitting retirement accounts hard. Congress's top budget analyst Peter Orszag says retirement funds have dropped by as much as 20%.
Over the past 15 months or so, pension plans have experienced a roughly $2 trillion decline in the value of their assets.
Continued losses could prompt people to delay retirement now. Consumer borrowing fell at a rate of 3.7% in August as individuals decreased their use of credit cards. That's the first time it's gone down this decade. The decline was most visible among car loans, with a decline of 8.4%. The UN General Assembly will meet today to vote the Serbian challenge of Kosovo's independence. Serbia wants the International Court of Justice to investigate the issue and find that Kosovo acted illegally. 47 countries, including the United States, have recognized Kosovo since it declared independence from Serbia back in February. And the International Olympic Committee will retest doping samples from the Beijing Games to check for traces of a new blood-boosting drug. The unprecedented move announced today is designed to search for a banned substance that was only recently detected during retesting of samples from the Tour de France.
You know, it's a big job. They keep that blood around for months and months and years.
I don't know how long they have to keep it, but the 5,000 samples they have to retest.
I wonder exactly what the drug does that they're searching for now.
Makes them stronger.
A little stronger, faster.
Yes, yeah. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Today, the New York Times has a story about a military report that's yet to be released, indicating a U.S. airstrike in Afghanistan in August took more civilian lives than the U.S. initially estimated. It was a raid that Afghan President Hamid Karzai immediately condemned, charging that 90 civilians had been killed, while the U.S. said seven. Now the U.S. is saying more than 30 civilians died. Eric Schmidt has been covering the story for The Times. He joins us now. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning.
So explain to us exactly how this estimate changed.
Well, what happened was immediately after this airstrike on August 22nd, the Special Operations Forces did a very quick review before they had to leave the areas. The villagers nearby were looking to retaliate. So they came up with a very quick estimate, roughly five civilians they believed had been killed in these strikes. After the outcry that followed shortly thereafter, both Afghan officials and the UN as well in Afghanistan, there was an initial investigating officer was sent to the region to try and pin down whether indeed the casualty level was higher. He came back and still pretty much stuck to the estimate of 5 to 7 civilian casualties with about 30 to 35 militants. That still didn't hold up in the wake of some cell phone footage of bodies that had been placed in mosques and other places. And so a couple weeks after the initial airstrikes, General David McKiernan, who's the senior American military commander in Afghanistan, requested yet another more thorough investigation. And that's what this report is now looking at. And they've come to a higher estimate based on a number of things. The investigating officer, who's a one-star general, was able to spend a lot more time at the scene of the incident, looking at the rubble that was there, discovered that there were many more bodies of civilians, including women and children, that had been buried in the rubble that the initial reviews had not been able to see. He also had the benefit of interviewing villagers to find out what they had seen, because many of the bodies had been taken away shortly after the strikes to be buried. And finally, there was just new evidence, the cell phone footage that was taken by villagers from their camera phones, if you will. And all this has gone into a report that is now before senior military commanders.
And it's really an important issue because essentially President Karzai has repeatedly said that unintended civilian deaths is not only making it difficult for his government to be taken seriously, but also his government's relationship with the U.S. and NATO troops and their mission on the ground there in Afghanistan.
That's right. And, of course, the U.S. has tried to be much more sensitive to the issue of civilian casualties. They realize that as more civilians are killed as they go after militants, it can have the opposite effect that they're trying to achieve. They can actually turn the population against the American-led effort in Afghanistan and have more people opposing what they're trying to do and working with the Karzai government. So it becomes a very difficult political problem for President Karzai to support the American effort and the more American operations there if civilians are dying in large numbers in these strikes.
Now, General McKiernan, who you just mentioned, actually issued orders following this incident, tightening rules about when NATO troops can use lethal force. Is that something that's widely understood in Afghanistan, and how did he change those rules?
Well, what he basically did was reaffirmed a change that his predecessor had made about a year earlier after a similar incident such as this, and that is that there needs to be extreme care taken when you do these kind of raids and airstrikes, that you evaluate the possibility of civilian casualties. Now, in this instance, the U.S. military asserts that their forces came under fire first from this Taliban compound and that the ground troops had to call in these airstrikes. So perhaps there wasn't as much time to assess the risk of casualties to civilians as there might have been in a pre-planned strike. But what McKiernan did here was basically reaffirm that and also reaffirm the principle that whenever possible, Afghan forces should be in the lead. And there were Afghan forces with these American Special Operations Forces on the ground. But again, as they came under fire, they said they needed the air cover that was provided. They called in an AC-130 gunship, which is quite a lethal aircraft, and the casualties apparently resulted from that.
Eric, stepping back for a second, though, I'm wondering if there's a pattern of a certain kind of recklessness here. If you look at the U.S. Increasing alienation from the Karzai government, and as well as the problems over on the Pakistan border with the airstrikes over there, if the U.S. is putting itself in an untenable, kind of isolated position at the very moment they're talking about a surge.
That's right, John. It is a very difficult situation. Again, the military does the best it can to assess the risks and minimize the risk to civilian casualties. But in many of these instances, what's happening is the families of some of these militants are with them, and oftentimes, tragically, they are killed as well, in addition to maybe other villages nearby. Now, it should be pointed out that my colleague Carlita Gall, when she went and visited this village shortly after these airstrikes, talked to them, and they said there weren't any Taliban in this village, and that these airstrikes were completely unnecessary. The military, in its report, continues to assert that this was a legitimate military target, that there were militants there, and they express regret for the civilian casualties.
Eric Schmidt, many thanks for that update.
You're welcome.
Eric Schmidt is the New York Times correspondent who was reporting to us from Washington, and now we're going to head over to Richard Haake, who's got a few headlines for us. Richard?
And don't panic.
Don't panic.
Oh, I won't. Go on. 21 minutes before the top of the hour. The Federal Reserve, though, is joining other central banks in a coordinated series of interest rate cuts. Most, including here in the U.S., are a half a point. Iceland's biggest bank will receive an emergency loan from Sweden. It's one of the many problems that's plagued the Nordic country. In the past week, Iceland has fixed the exchange rate of its currency and asked Russia for a $5.4 billion loan. Meanwhile, the British government is establishing a rescue plan of its own. It announced details this morning of a package for the banking system worth up to nearly $90 billion. Prime Minister Gordon Brown says it's essential.
The problems that started in America have now hurt every banking system in every continent of the world. The global financial market has ceased to function, putting in danger the necessary flow of money to businesses and families on which all of us depend in our daily lives.
He's got a lot of nerve. Is he blaming the whole thing on us?
It's always our fault.
Yeah, I guess.
The capital will be available to 8 of the UK's largest banks. And apparently Americans are scaling back their spending even more this September, resulting in weak sales for many retailers. As already skittish consumers grapple with this financial meltdown, the weak reports are fueling more worries about the holiday season and the overall economy, since consumer spending accounts for 2/3 of all economic activity. And Defense Secretary Robert Gates today is urging southeastern European leaders to shift their military efforts from Iraq to Afghanistan, where forces are more urgently needed. He spoke at a meeting here of the Southeast European Defense Ministerial. Gates said that he, as the security situation in Iraq continues to improve, countries should consider filing the urgent need for trainers in Afghanistan. And finally, a top South Korean military officer says that North Korea is trying to develop a nuclear warhead that's small enough to be carried by missiles.
Their warheads are too big. Oh. Great, that's reassuring.
Thanks,
thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. And you know, at this point in the global financial crisis, everyone is getting into the act of reassurance. And of course, some people are better at it than others.
The days are dim right now for a lot of folks, but I firmly believe tomorrow's going to be brighter.
That's President Bush, of course. Not bad, not great, but not bad. You really have to feel sorry for Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, though. Here he is yesterday.
The intensification of financial turmoil and the further impairment of the functioning of credit markets seem likely to increase the restraint on economic activity in the period ahead.
As he spoke, the U.S. stock markets dropped about 3%. 3%. You know, I think this is a good soundtrack for some voices of other world leaders who this week in their own languages were reassuring their own citizens.
Dificuldades sérias. Mas é justamente neste momento que vos quero dizer que o Estado não deixará.
That's the Portuguese Prime Minister José Sócrates insisting the state will do its duty.
Nous déclarons
chef d'État et chef de gouvernement. Que chacun d'entre eux.
French President Sarkozy, each of us will take all measures necessary to ensure the stability of the financial system.
Проблема международной политики, кризис мировой финансовой системы.
Russian President Dmitry Medvedev getting in on the reassurance business. His stock market, did you know, is down about 62% this year, calling for urgent action. And this Egyptian stockbroker is close to tears. There were no buyers yesterday on the Egyptian stock exchange. None, he says.
In a situation like this, it's every man for himself, every country for itself. Everybody's taking care of the investment.
That's Iceland's Prime Minister, Gerhard. He's trying to reassure someone, every man for himself. I don't know if that's really working.
Don't worry, be happy. Ain't got no place to lay your head.
You know, maybe we need some different tools here. I mean, there is history. We might remember that famous FDR line. What was it? The only thing we have to fear.
We have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror.
That was a classic, of course. And then Rodney King, remember he had this simple question when the streets of L.A. were on fire.
Can we all get along? Can we get along?
You know, it took me just a few minutes to check, and there are at least 42 ways of saying don't panic. Here are a few.
Tranquillo.
Sois cool.
Ni buon notte, tovarishi.
Reste calme.
Non ti lasciare prendere dal panico.
Paniquez pas.
Ya tokchai.
Shinpai shinaide.
There's also yek ma in Turkish. Ant de anikpe, that's pig Latin. Even ilim ko in Klingon. 42 ways to say don't panic. You know, in the next few weeks, I think we're going to need every single one of them.
Because when you're worried, your face will frown, and that will bring everybody down. So don't worry, be happy, don't worry.
America needs you now. We want you to pick up the phone and call 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us in your own words, in your own language, how not to panic. Don't panic. The takeaway.
Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry. Be happy.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, October 8th, and Richard Hake is here with the latest headlines of the hour. Richard?
And Adora, it's 12 minutes before the top of the hour. The Fed has announced an emergency rate cut of a half a point to 1.5%. The European Central Bank, the Bank of England, Sweden, and China will also join the U.S. in coordinated series of interest rate cuts. In testimony before the House Oversight Committee, top executives at AIG blamed wider economic tremors for its company's problems. The former chief accountant for the Securities and Exchange Commission, Lynn Turner, says the executive's explanation doesn't hold water.
AIG, in a move that appears to deflect criticism, blamed its problems on accounting rules, which require it to disclose losses to its investors. This is like blaming the thermometer folks for a fever.
AIG used $61 billion of the $85 billion it received from the government last month. Those are some of the headlines this morning.
Thanks, Richard.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Richard. So last night, the candidates, John McCain and Barack Obama, sparred in a war of words. And, you know, that's what candidates do. They debate, they campaign, and they also deliver memorable lines that sometimes go down in history. So who's the better commander of language in chief, whatever that means? This campaign season has seen some zingers from the presidential and vice presidential candidates. There, of course, is this one.
I love those hockey moms. You know, they say the difference between a hockey mom and a pit bull? Lipstick.
And let's say this one's skewing a little more serious.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
and, of course, John F. Kennedy. Politicians come up with zingers, sound bites, and historical quotables that pass the test of time. But here to distinguish between these is our dear friend James Geary, who's a linguist, journalist, and author of The World in a Phrase, A History of the Aphorism, and also Geary's Guide to the World's Greatest Aphorists. James, thanks for joining us from London.
My pleasure. Thank you.
First of all, would you call the hockey mom line of Sarah Palin an aphorism, a soundbite, or a memorable quote?
I would call it an aphorism, and it's one of those aphorisms that are very, very similar to jokes. And her aphorism about the pit bull and the lipstick is clearly a joke. She delivers the punchline. But aphorisms are, in many ways, very similar to jokes, shorn of everything but the punchline. There's a moment when you get an aphorism, just like you get a joke, and often it, just like a joke, an aphorism will reverse your expectations. So I would definitely classify Palin's joke as a full-fledged aphorism.
Now, who are some of your favorites? I mean, there are a lot of aphorisms. I mean, and we also like to think of ourselves as living at a sort of degraded, maybe we don't like to think of ourselves, but we tend to say that we live at a time of degraded discourse and that the greatest aphorists were down through history. What are some of your favorites?
Well, I think especially in politics with the trend towards everything being focused, grouped, and researched, I think the best aphorisms come from the gut, not necessarily the heart, but the gut. They're very punchy, they're very quick, they're very sharp, and often they're very, very cutting. And I think, as you saw in the debate last night, the candidates are loath to say anything too provocative, to say anything too challenging. But as the clip from JFK shows, it hasn't always been the case. And I think one of the great aphorists, who was also happened to be a U.S. president, is Harry Truman. And he was someone who spoke a lot off the cuff, and he had a very sort of folksy, down-home way of talking, sort of like Sarah Palin's manner. And a very appropriate aphorism of his is, it's a recession when your neighbor loses his job. It's a depression when you lose
right,
yours.
That's right, a great right, one. Yeah. That is a great one. You know, McCain last night used an aphorism in the debate, a very famous one from Teddy Roosevelt. Listen here.
You know, my hero is a guy named Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt used to say, walk softly, talk softly, but carry a big stick. Senator Obama likes to talk loudly.
There he botches the aphorism and tries to work Obama in there. Well, what do you think of that moment?
That's a great moment, and I think that's it's a great example of how aphorisms work in daily life, not just for presidential candidates, but for everybody. Aphorisms are literally words of wisdom, words to live by. And, you know, McCain often cites Teddy Roosevelt, Ronald Reagan as his heroes. And that aphorism, talk softly, carry a big stick, becomes a sort of active principle in a person's mind. And that's what guides their policies. So I think that aphorism is a sort of very concise statement of what McCain's foreign policy would be.
James, does an aphorism only work if it sheds some kind of light or brings clarity to the point at hand?
Well, no. I think, I think this is another reason why we don't hear so many aphorisms in political discourse. Is an aphorism is intended to be unsettling and to be provocative, and I think that's not necessarily what presidential candidates want to create in their listeners. And you know, so the difference between an aphorism and a slogan, for example, a political slogan, something like "Change you can believe in," that's not an aphorism because it's sort of meaningless. It doesn't really have any content,
right.
And that's done specifically by design.
Are you saying that Barack Obama is meaningless, James? His slogan is just plain pointless.
No, I'm not saying that at all. But what I am saying is that eloquence can often get in the way of a good aphorism.
Well, you know, that
someone like Obama, who tends to, I mean, he's toned it down a lot since the primaries, but he can veer into sort of lecturing and become very professorial. And that's not the ideal situation in which to deliver an aphorism, because an aphorism has a short, sharp shock,
right.
Like, you know, talk softly but carry a big stick.
Well, sometimes aphorisms can get in the way of your candidacy. I actually thought during the primary campaign, Huckabee had some really interesting zingers here. Listen to this one, James.
The question was, from the viewer, was, what would Jesus do? Would Jesus support the death penalty?
Jesus was too smart to ever run for public office, Anderson. That's what Jesus would do.
That's a wonderful example of the way that, you know, really good aphorists are so quick on their feet that they will just deliver a remark like that off the cuff. And I think that's a quality that a lot of politicians in the past had, Harry Truman, Teddy Roosevelt, certainly, and that politicians today, they want to tone down and control, because you don't want to be saying, you know, everything's been so choreographed that you don't want to veer off the script and say something that might offend your base or, you know, put off swing voters and things like that. But that's a great remark.
All right, here's one more from Huckabee. I can't resist this one.
It ought to be at least as difficult to get across an international border as it is to get on an airplane in our own hometown.
Now, he's talking about immigration policy. He's trying to put together a snappy phrase. It's in his commercial. Any chance that will make the aphorism, pass the aphorism test?
It's a little too specific. I mean, it's right. As you said, it's about a specific issue. And I think the greatest aphorisms are universally applicable in any time. Even if they occur in the context of a specific historical situation, they still will apply outside that. And if you listen, I mean, thinking back to last night's debate, in my opinion, the best aphorism of the night, and one of the best of the campaign so far, was the question that was delivered at the very, very end by a woman in New Hampshire.
All right, let's
what
listen to it.
Don't you know?
Let's
you have
let's
it
listen
tape.
To it. Yeah, we have it right
okay,
here.
Okay, great.
Gentlemen, we've come to the last question from Peggy in Amherst, New Hampshire. It has a certain Zen-like quality. I'll give you a fair warning. She says, what don't you know, and how will you learn it?
You know, it's like, Brokaw, get out of the way. She knows what she's saying. That was great. Peggy in Amherst. Why do you like that one?
Because I think the virtue of aphorisms is they make you question your assumptions and your beliefs. And I think given the unprecedented challenges that were economically, politically, that the whole world is going through now, I think aphorisms, what they tend to do is make you question things. And by questioning long-held assumptions, to lead you to potentially new solutions and new ideas.
That's great.
And I think it's interesting to note that neither candidate answered that question. They
<That's>
both
great.
Immediately went into, you know, yep. I was raised by a single
right.
mom and
there
I know I served in Vietnam. They went back on their, you know, the old biographical American dream bit.
What don't I know and how will I learn it? James Geary, thanks so much. Linguist, journalist, author of The World in a Phrase, A History of the Aphorism, and also Geary's Guide to the World's Greatest Aphorists.
I'm going to come up with my own aphorism. I think I'm going to do that.
I think you've already delivered a few in the show. Yes, indeed.
Anyhow, we are always on at The Takeaway, and if you're looking for some place for Election Day coverage or anything about the campaign, go to vote2008.thetakeaway.org.
We've got all kinds of tools, commentary from young voters, posts from bloggers who watch the campaigns from abroad, a link to all of our election coverage from our homepage at thetakeaway.org.
And how do you say panic?
For all of those who are wondering how to say don't panic in Russian, the way you say it is не паникуйте.
Не паникуйте. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. That's how you say don't panic.
In Russian, here's today's takeaway.
All of these big international banks have been playing the international markets, have been taking what now appear to be extraordinarily silly risks. Now's the day of reckoning.
That's the BBC's Alex Ritson talking about the global banking crisis.
All of our Wall Street coverage is on iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Okay, we learn when the crisis hit, executives from AIG, the insurance giant, assembled to assess damage control.
They were getting their manicures, their facials, their pedicures, and their massages while American people were footing the bill.
That's Congressman Elijah Cummings describing a lavish retreat for AIG executives at a resort in California that took place after the feds took over AIG. When it hurts too much to laugh, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, October 8th, and it just made me wonder, how much spa treatments, how many do you think $440,000 can buy you?
I don't know, but if you're bankrupt, you know, you really need a massage, I guess.
I suppose. We're going to get to more on that story. But this morning, we have a report on the Federal Reserve. New moves today to calm the anxious markets. Also, Americans don't just watch debates these days. They blog them online. We'll look at what their blogs tell us about the race. And we're also going to explore the green movement and some who promise it will create jobs and boost the economy. But first, a few headlines.
The Fed is throwing the switch and other banks are on board. The Federal Reserve ordered an emergency interest rate cut of a half a point. Normally, rate cuts come at Fed meetings, but that wasn't soon enough for the struggling economy. The European Central Bank, the Banks of England, and other banks are also cutting rates. The move seems to be working. U.S. markets are poised to open up, although there's been a lot of volatility on the futures this morning. European markets have also rallied after early drops. News of the rate cuts came too late for Asian markets, though. Japan's Nikkei index went into a free fall. It dropped 9.4%, the biggest plunge in 21 years.
And while the Fed works with rates, President Bush is trying to use words to boost the economy.
The days are dim right now for a lot of folks, but I firmly believe tomorrow's going to be brighter.
The clock is ticking on his administration. The two men fighting for his job debated in Nashville last night. Barack Obama and John McCain talked about energy and the environment. Obama continued to paint McCain as more of the same.
Senator McCain and I actually agree on something. He said a while back that the big problem with energy is that for 30 years, politicians in Washington haven't done anything. What Senator McCain doesn't mention is he's been there 26 of them.
McCain defended his record and cited his willingness to break with his own party.
I have disagreed strongly with the Bush administration on this issue. I traveled all over the world looking at the effects of greenhouse gas emissions.
The candidates hit the trail again this morning. McCain and Sarah Palin hold events in Ohio and Pennsylvania. Obama heads to Indiana.
Two Americans and a Japanese scientist are sharing the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. It honors their work on a green fluorescent protein. The Defense Department now admits a U.S. airstrike in August killed some 30 civilians in Afghanistan, far more than previously acknowledged.
And with all this bad economic news, we're asking about what you think about panic.
This is James Nave. I'm calling from I-78, headed west into Pennsylvania and New Jersey. I just wanted to say the sun is coming up, sky is clear, there are a wisp or two of clouds in the sky, so really, don't panic.
What's your advice on how to handle this news? How are you not panicking and staying calm? We want to hear your advice at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
How do you say don't panic on The Takeaway?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Overall, the combination of the incoming data and recent financial developments suggests that the outlook for economic growth has worsened and that the downside risks to growth have increased.
That's Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke in a speech yesterday where he hinted that the Fed would lower interest rates, but few expected that it would happen this morning. A key interest rate was cut by a half percentage point this morning, but no one would have expected that that move would be coordinated with six global central banks, the Bank of England, the European Central Bank, China. Markets in Europe rallied on the news, although Asian markets closed before the news and dropped sharply. Joining us now is New York Times reporter Edmund Andrews. Ed, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, John.
And my first question is, so is Bernanke the Fed chairman or is he banker of the universe?
Well, I think right now he is the banker looking for as many allies as he can find. He's looking for all the help he can find.
This was a pretty unprecedented move, the fact that it was coordinated all across the globe like this.
It was it's totally unprecedented. We have had, of course, coordinated currency interventions from time to time. We have never had a coordinated rate cut of this fashion before. The closest we've ever come is in November 2001, the ECB, the European Central Bank, reduced its rate on the same day as the Fed, but that was not truly a coordinated action, and it certainly didn't involve, five other banks.
Well, this week, we began the week with a lot of volatility, and there was some concern that the Eurozone would be unable to mobilize a kind of concerted effort that the U.S. managed to do, even ham-handedly with Congress, in passing the bailout rescue package. But now it seems as though the Fed strategy is to project as much coordinated, lockstep action as they possibly can, given the limitations. Would you agree?
Yes. Well, we have to distinguish between the European Central Bank on monetary policy and the European governments on fiscal policy. They still don't have a coordinated fiscal policy. The Fed has been working in concert with the European Central Bank and the other ones for all along, but they haven't taken it to this level before. The good news, and the reason that this isn't entirely shocking, is that the ECB and the Fed have a basically common philosophy about economics and about monetary policy. There's some differences. There are some important differences and divergences, but they talk the same language, I guess is what I'm saying. And the ECB is a Eurozone-wide institution, although it doesn't cover England. Fortunately, the Bank of England and the Swiss National Bank were also participating, so that pretty much covers Europe.
And, of course, the U.K. has intervened significantly in the banking sector there. Why did the Bank of Japan not join this effort?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know.
Sort of interesting. They did say they supported the action, although maybe it's possibly a matter of timing, and we'll see some action from Tokyo tomorrow. Is there a domestic strategy in this, or is it all global at this point, Ed?
It is. It's kind of hard to separate at this point because the problem is fundamentally in the United States, and we're the ones who are causing the difficulties everywhere else in the world. But what's now happened, of course, is that because this contagion has moved from the United States to Europe and Asia, it's coming back to hit us. And so it's both domestic and global. But at the end of the day, we have to solve the problems here first. If we don't solve the problems here, the rest of the world will be in bad shape.
Well, and indeed, the European markets have reacted negatively to this after they've had a chance to think about it. And you've got the futures, which surged when this was announced. And then all of a sudden, now the futures on Wall Street are significantly down. Ed Andrews, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, John.
Edmund Andrews is a reporter for the New York Times, reporting on the Fed decision and this coordinated effort to reduce interest rates. Adora?
An unprecedented move, and so therefore an unprecedented end result. Clearly going to keep an eye on that. And in the midst of all of this terrible economic news, there is this presidential debate and presidential campaign. And last night was the second debate between John McCain and Barack Obama. Among many things, they were asked if health care is a right or a responsibility.
I think it's a responsibility in this respect, in that we should have available and affordable health care to every American citizen.
I think it should be a right for every American.
Not only were people watching across the country, but they were also online blogging on the Politico blog, The Arena. Current and former elected officials to regular voters were putting in their two cents. Politico senior editor Fred Barbesh was moderating, and he joins us now. He's on the line from Washington. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Fred.
Good morning. It's my pleasure.
So give us an overview of what people were blogging about.
Well, it's very interesting. The theme of the blogging, if you will, was kind of bring back Sarah. People were bored. People were unhappy with the format. Ron Bonjane, who was an old hand on the Hill, one of the senior strategists there, said the mechanical Abraham Lincoln robot from Epcot Center would keep the attention span of more Americans than this debate could ever do. Tom Brokaw has now completely hijacked the questions to try to save this failed format. One of my participants, Daniela Leger, sent me a note right in the middle saying, I thought this was going to be exciting. I'm flipping through my BlackBerry after 20 minutes. And I've got to tell you, I sense from my reader reaction that it'd be interesting to see the ratings, because I think people were falling off, turning off, nodding off during this debate. And my group, which includes not just elected officials, but scholars and activists of every kind, basically these are people who are intensely interested in the issues.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are bored, then I can imagine what the citizen who doesn't have a lot of time to study issues must have been feeling during this debate. And a lot of it, the reaction on Arena was attributable to the forum, and they wished that it hadn't been done this way. There was a real absence of interaction between the people who essentially were stick figures and the candidates who did not interact with them, and Brokaw's kind of booming authoritative voice trying to cut off the comments and let's stick to the format here and let's watch those lights. And you know,
it's a tough position that he's in.
I was actually
blogging too, Fred, and I was really impressed by the number of people who multitask, who were commenting on the debate as it was unfolding. But let's go beyond the specifics of the forum.
Sure.
There certainly were some specific big themes, one of them being that John McCain went into this debate lagging in the polls. And so there was this sense that somehow he's got to turn his campaign around. And last night was the opportunity to do it. What did your blogger say about his performance and what he had to say?
Most of them felt that he did fine, but not fine enough. He had to score both substantively and stylistically, if you will, a significant gain out of this. And he did not, and therefore, to the extent that he didn't, you've got the status quo, and the status quo, especially with the news that you've just reported, strongly favors Obama. Celinda Lake, who is a pollster and generally careful about these things, sent a note towards the end, essentially declaring the election over. Yeah, well, so she quickly qualified that.
Well,
so
but Fred, there, you know, that's consistent. I watched Gergen briefly on CNN before the debate began. I mean, he was all over. It's over for McCain. I mean, he was very, very negative and said that McCain had to hit it totally out of the park to even have a chance. I'm surprised. Are you hearing that from people like Gergen?
Dave is not on this forum, but yes, that's the same theme that he, you know, these people don't sit and take careful notes about the issues here. They make an overall judgment, and that judgment either moves the needle or doesn't move the needle. And the feeling was that to the extent it moved the needle at all last night, it was not in McCain's direction. So it being on a sort of bad curve as it is, that's pretty bad news for him. And this economy news that just gets worse and worse every
right,
morning,
indeed.
You know. And I think that kind of cast a pall over the whole debate, to tell you the truth.
Fred Barbash, we can't thank you enough for coming back to The Takeaway.
It's my pleasure.
Fred Barbash is a senior editor at Politico.com, and he moderates the Arena page.
So speaking of economic statistics, here's a mind blower. Gold is up $38 today. That is panic buying. How do you say don't panic in English or any other language? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
My way of saying don't panic is breathe in, breathe out. Breathe in, breathe out.
And buy gold. It's now $40 up. That's crazy.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hi, my name is Ben from Jersey City. And in Filipino, the way you say don't panic is, huminahon ka.
Thank you very much. Now, there's a thought to keep in mind this morning as the markets are poised to open down in about 8 minutes. How do you say don't panic in English or any other language? Can you give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE? We want to hear from you. John?
And as Adora said, the Dow futures are down more than 280 points, at least at the last moment we checked, and the S&P futures are down a similar amount. European markets are wildly fluctuating this morning on news of a coordinated global central bank rate cut. Should be positive news, but it's not. The ripple effect of the U.S. financial crisis is being felt around the world, and confidence is hard to find. If you listen to the headlines, you hear things like it's the worst since 1987, the worst since 2000, worst since 1929. Well, for some context, historical and otherwise, on what's been happening in the markets, we're joined by John Steele Gordon, whose history books have chronicled the many ups and downs in our economic history. He's an author and a business and economic historian. John, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
As you look at these numbers and see these sell-offs, I mean, there's a certain amount of this that is unprecedented because we exist in a different technological and global age on some level. But I imagine there's a lot of this that has echoes in the past.
Oh, certainly. We've had, in this country especially, we've had this kind of financial crisis roughly every 20 years. I mean, we had 1792, 1819, 1836, 1857, 1873, 1893, and so on.
Man, you're good.
That sounds like a lot of bad times.
Yeah.
Well, it takes about once a generation for people to forget the lessons of the previous crash.
Right, there you go. Now, does that mean you withdrew all of your money from the stock market about a month ago?
No.
Right. So you're a historian, but you're not wise. I guess that's what we would say.
I look at the past, not the future.
So let's talk about the sort of share price problems here that are related to banks lending these risky kinds of investments, credit default swaps, crazy things like this. Was that a problem in 1929?
Not specifically, no. The problem in 1929 was very high margin. You could buy stocks on 10%. Put 10% down and the broker would lend you the other 90%. Well, that's a great way to make money if the market's going up, but you get wiped out almost instantly if it's going down.
Right. Is this reminiscent of maybe the, like, tulip disaster that took place over in Holland, you know, hundreds of years ago?
It's a bit more like that, although, the tulip bulbs that were the basis of that mania were just tulip bulbs. In this case, at least, somewhere down deep under all those securities, there's a house.
Yeah, maybe, although it's just paper. I mean, with a tulip bulb, you at least get some tulips if you plant it in the ground.
Yes.
Yeah, right. I mean, some of this paper is going to be worth absolutely nothing. So are there any other issues, for instance, the globalness of this market, sell-off? Certainly in 1929, we entered a worldwide recession. Do you expect that the similar kinds of rhythms are putting that into the cards today?
Well, the market is and the economy is so much more globalized today than it was in 1929 that, whenever one major country gets into a financial trouble, then the whole rest of the world is going to be affected by it. But this is not actually very new. Markets have been globalized for an astonishingly long period of time. The crash of 1907 actually started when the stock market crashed in Alexandria, Egypt.
Oh,
really? Oh, that's interesting.
John, you say that we are so far away from what happened in 1929. When you look at some of the specifics, like 20,000 farms were being foreclosed on a month in 1933, or that banks were closed entirely in 38 states at that time. Very different today.
Very different. We have so much more extensive a safety net. We have, the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, insures all bank accounts up to $250,000 as of last week. We had none of that in the Depression, and so 5,000 banks went out of business in 1932 alone.
It's hard to
took the savings of people with them.
It's hard to imagine banks closed in 38 states completely. But there's one other sort of echo from 1929 that maybe is alarming to think about today. I mean, the stock market of 29 was a three-day fiasco, but it took 3 years to actually hit bottom. Could that be what's going on today?
Well, we have no idea where the bottom is. I wish I did. We could make a lot of money if we knew. What,
we could get out of the historian business, right?
Right.
Yeah, this radio gig I got going here.
Right, and yeah, whether it was the depression of 1929 that started in 1929 lasted up until March of 1933, at which point a very slow recovery began.
Mm-hmm.
So that was 3.5 years. And the stock market actually bottomed in the summer of 1932 at about, down about 90% from its 1929 high.
90%. Well, that is a sobering number. John Steele Gordon, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay.
John Steele Gordon is an author and business and economic historian. And we have very current headlines from Richard Hake.
And, John, right now 27 minutes past the hour. The market opens in just a few minutes. Futures are down right now more than 200 points. That's despite news that the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, Sweden, and China will join the United States in coordinated series of interest rate cuts. The Federal Reserve announced earlier this morning that it's cutting the key interest rate by 0.5 point. That emergency cut brings it to 1.5%. The UN General Assembly will meet today to vote the Serbian challenge of Kosovo's independence. Serbia wants the International Court of Justice to investigate the issue and find that Kosovo acted illegally. 47 countries, including the United States, have recognized Kosovo since it declared independence from Serbia in February. A U.S. federal judge is ordering the government to free 17 Muslim Chinese detainees from Guantanamo to American soil. It's the first such order since the military jail opened in 2002. The U.S. Justice Department says it will appeal. The testimony of the prosecution star witness Bill Allen wrapped yesterday in the trial of Alaskan Senator Ted Stevens. Bill Allen testified that he provided more than $250,000 in renovations and gifts to Stevens. The senator is accused of lying on financial disclosure forms to conceal the gifts. And finally, all this week, the Nobel Prizes are being awarded. This morning, it was for chemistry. Here's the announcement from Sweden.
The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has decided to award the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for the year 2008 jointly to Professor Martin Chalfy, Professor Osamu Shimomura, and Professor Roger Chan for the discovery and development of the green fluorescent protein GFP.
And that's two American and a Japanese scientist, and of course that fluorescent protein can be found in jellyfish.
What was the runner-up? Took them a while
to announce the winners. I don't think they'd still be sitting there.
That's true.
They were talking about the runners up too. So,
thank you, Richard.
Thank you for that, Richard.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I want to know what you would do within the first 2 years to make sure that Congress moves fast as far as environmental issues like climate change and green jobs.
You probably heard several voters last night at the presidential debate asking about energy independence and the candidates' energy policies. It's an issue that both presidential candidates agree is critical, but of course they see the solutions very differently. Joining us now is author and environmental activist Van Jones, who's just written the book, The Green Collar Economy, and he has an argument for the next president, something he might want to consider, which is how to help the environment, boost the economy, and create jobs. So you must be pleased that the presidential candidates are talking about energy independence.
Well, I sure am. It was awesome to see that young African-American woman asking a question about green jobs.
Yes.
So I think it's a good sign that people are paying attention. My argument is that this clean energy revolution that's trying to happen, if we can get the government on the side of it, right now the government's on the side of the problem makers in the U.S. economy, the polluters, the Pentagon, but the problem solvers, our solar industry, our wind industry, have not gotten support they need. If we can get the government on the side of the problem solvers, we can create a tremendous number of jobs and jumpstart this economy.
Let's listen to a bit of what each candidate said about their proposals. First here, it's Barack Obama.
Energy we have to deal with today. That's why I've called for an investment of $15 billion a year over 10 years. Our goal should be, in 10 years' time, we are free of dependence on Middle Eastern oil. And we can do it.
And let's hear what John McCain said.
We can move forward and clean up our climate and develop green technologies and alternative energies for hybrid, for hydrogen, for battery-powered cars, so that we can clean up our environment and at the same time get our economy going by creating millions of jobs. We can do that.
So, Van, John McCain seems to be agreeing explicitly with you there. What are they not saying that you think is important?
Well, I mean, you know, what we're seeing with John McCain is the rise of a new phenomenon in American politics. I call it the rise of the dirty greens. You have these, you know, now every politician, and you had greenwashing corporations before. They had the same toxic processes and dirty products, but they would put, you know, a green wrapper on it. People, oh, well, maybe it's an environmental product. Now you have greenwashing politicians. And he said, oh, we want all of the above. What does that mean? Well, he wants renewable energy. He wants solar panels. He wants windmills. He also wants nuclear power, oil, shale, tar sands, you know, I guess burning kittens, you know, any carbon-based dirty fuel is fine with him. Well, we can't have that. You can't mix up the moving in a clean energy direction with going backwards to get the most dirty polycarbons burned. And so now we've got to be more clear. When we're talking about clean energy and alternatives, we mean actual clean, renewable, safe, and not going further down the road of the dirty, dangerous stuff.
And thinking differently about all of this. I mean, right. McCain calls for replacing, right, you know, the non-green with the green, and basically we're going to have the same number of cars. You're saying, actually, we got to think radically differently about the way we do things.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what you want to think about is how many more jobs are there going to be in the coal mines or on the oil rigs versus putting up millions and millions of solar panels, building thousands and thousands of wind farms, manufacturing the wind turbines, 8,000 finely machined parts in every wind turbine. You can put Detroit back to work, not making SUVs to destroy the world, but making wind turbines to help save the world, fabricating those solar panels. There's a huge jobs agenda here that actually brings jobs up, energy prices down, carbon down, restarts the economy, but you've got to be serious about it. I'm concerned now that everybody can put a solar panel in there and their political ad, but are you actually going to have a political agenda that gets us there?
And what do you think some of the main obstacles are at this point? I mean, you were very involved last year in an act that passed in Congress,
right,
setting out many millions of dollars to help train up, right, to 35,000 Americans, right?
Yes, in green-collar work. Well, I mean, we have a number of problems. Number one, we could pass the best laws in the world to sort of fight global warming, but senators don't put up solar panels. And what we're seeing in places like Northern California, where there's tremendous consumer demand for solar power, we don't have the trained workforce to put them up.
So tell the story of Rodney Lee.
Well, okay. You have Rodney Lee. I also want to tell the story of a guy in Chicago, but I'll start with Rodney Lee, who is desperately trying to get employed. He wants to have a job.
Used to work for the phone company.
Yeah, used to work for the phone.
Had a long illness.
Exactly. And then gets back into the game through the green economy.
Government training program, and he ends up putting up solar panels, and he's actually managing that operation.
Exactly. Going from just being on a rooftop to becoming a manager and then hopefully someday an owner. We call it green pathways out of poverty. If we have the job training programs in place, we can take people who are standing in the back of the line for the present pollution-based jobs that are leaving the country, put them in the front of the line for the new clean and green jobs that are coming.
And that's jobs that would stay here.
Jobs that would, right, stay here, because it's very hard to outsource solar panel installation. You can't take a house you want to put solar panels on, ship it overseas, have them do it on the cheap, and then send it back. These are jobs that have to be done here. And the other thing I just want to say is that as you begin to think about, you know, how are you going to get the economy started again, where's our manufacturing agenda? We are now leaving the era, as of this week, where the U.S. economy could be based on consumption rather than production, debt rather than smart savings, and environmental destruction rather than environmental restoration. The clean, green economy of the future will be based on producing things here, smart savings, both, you know, the government being smart with its money and also individual people, and more importantly, restoring the environment rather than destroying the environment. That is a majority agenda. That's not some wacko Seattle or Cambridge
lefty,
or
tree lefty tree-hugging agenda.
That is now how we are going to power and restart the U.S. economy.
Van Jones has given us something to think about. He's the author of The Green Collar Economy and founding president of Green for All. And Van, you're going to stick around with us for the rest of the hour, because right now we're going to get the latest headlines from Richard Hake, who's sitting in for Femi Okeh. Richard?
Adora, 21 minutes before the top of the hour, Wall Street is down again after a rate cut by the Federal Reserve and other central banks failed to calm investors' worries about stagnant credit markets. While investors have sought the 1.5-point cut by the Fed, they realize that a rate reduction won't help make credit easier for businesses and consumers to get anytime soon. The credit markets aren't showing any immediate signs of relaxing. Executives from the insurance giant AIG testified before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee yesterday. They came under fire from committee chairman Henry Waxman for spending $400,000 in a spa retreat right after receiving a federal bailout.
Less than 1 week after the taxpayers rescued AIG, company executives could be found whining and dining at one of the most exclusive resorts in the nation.
AIG said the trip was to reward top-selling insurance agents, not executives. A United States federal judge is ordering the government to free 17 Muslim Chinese detainees from Guantanamo Bay. It's the first such order since the military jail opened in 2002. The U.S. Justice Department says it will appeal. Rebel groups using child soldiers in the Philippines could face prosecution in the United States under a new law. The Child Soldiers Accountability Act was signed into law last week. So now it's a federal crime to recruit and use soldiers under the age of 15, even if they operate outside the U.S.
And well, I wonder how they're going to
enforce that.
How do you enforce that outside of our borders?
I guess if they come
really
here.
Big policemen. A huge one. Yeah.
Richard, thank you.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. U.S. markets have opened, and really, quite frankly, they don't know what to make of the major news this morning, which includes central banks, including the Federal Reserve, cutting interest rates in an unprecedented coordinated effort aimed at restoring confidence in the market, and the extraordinary intervention on the part of the U.K. government into the financial sector in Britain. Joining us this morning is New York Times columnist Gretchen Morgenson. Gretchen, thanks for being with us.
Sure. Happy to be here.
After being down about 110 points this morning, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is now up, and the S&P is sort of fluctuating around zero, flat this morning. Meanwhile, gold looks to be poised to make a record move today. It's up $40 an ounce. What is going on here?
Well, certainly a flight to safety. Typically you see investors rushing to Treasury bills or bonds, a full faith and credit of the United States government behind them. But I think that people are starting to get wind of the notion that with all of these bailouts that we are having, the Treasury's balance sheet is getting bloated, and you've also got a problem with possible inflation ahead. When you have this much sort of money being printed with abandon, that's definitely inflationary. And gold is a protection against that.
So inflation is all about the overprinting of money. And at least on the part of the validity of the security of the Treasury bills, that's a simple arithmetic. People are adding up just how much the Fed is on the hook for and looking at the number of T-bills, and it just doesn't add up.
Well, what I also want to make clear, and a lot of people talk about these things as government bailouts, they really are taxpayer bailouts, because the taxpayer is the one who is on the hook for the losses, if there are any, and we are almost certain to have some. And so how that works is, it basically just means that the borrowing and the buying power of your dollar is far lower than it would have been otherwise, and that's not a good thing, whether or not it means you're traveling abroad and you can't buy as much as you would have had the dollar been stronger, but also even in your own country. An inflationary spiral is something that just absolutely reduces wealth across the board.
Gretchen, but wouldn't you be more likely to see at least some confidence that perhaps with the European officials and the U.S. financial officials all working in concert, that perhaps we are closer to some kind of resolution of what's troubling the market?
Well, we're certainly closer to a resolution, but I think that what is being reflected in the fear factor that's out there is the idea that really government is kind of, our officials are really kind of doing it on an ad hoc basis. It's from putting fires out here, there, and everywhere, when really there's a conflagration all around us. And so I think there's still a sense of a lack of confidence that we have the officials responding in a concerted way. We see that more and more now. Certainly the Fed was standing in to buy commercial paper from American corporations, which is something that has not happened since the Depression, is a good thing to do. It will help to unfreeze the credit markets, which will get, really have good effect on the economy. But the fact is that I think that the response by the authorities has been sort of late in the game, and now they're playing catch up.
Yeah, well, if the word is today what to go into, it's not plastics. It's definitely gold. Gretchen Mortensen, assistant business and financial editor and a columnist for the New York Times. Thanks for being with us.
Anytime.
Gold finger. He's the man with the Midas touch. A spider's touch.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. With all of this economic news today, we're asking you, what's your advice on what not to do, how not to panic?
Hi, Ann Denning, former Lehman employee for 31 years, and my take on how to face and not panic is to thank God for every day we have, because after my diagnosis with breast cancer, I survived that, and I look at all of these other issues as obstacles that we can all face together. So hopefully everybody rises above the panic.
Some good thoughts there. Think of it as just an obstacle, the bad financial market. Anyhow, give us a call with your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And now we're going to get some headlines from Richard Hake, who's in for Femi. Okay, Richard.
And Adora, 11 minutes before the top of the hour, Wall Street down again after a rate cut by the Federal Reserve failed to calm investors worried about stagnant credit markets. The European Central Bank, the Bank of England, Sweden, and China also joining the U.S. in coordinated series of interest rate cuts. The British government is establishing a bailout all of its own. The government announced details this morning of a rescue package for the banking system worth up to nearly $90 billion. And Iceland's biggest bank will receive an emergency loan from Sweden. It's one of the many problems that's plagued the Nordic country. In the past week, the fixed exchange rate of its currency, it asked Russia for $5.4 billion. And finally, you've probably heard about drunk dialing. Well, now Google is offering users a way to prevent late-night drunken email sending. The feature requires the emailer to solve a few math problems in a set amount of time before being allowed to hit the send button. It's called Google Goggles.
Google Goggles.
Google Goggles.
Right, well, that's something we need.
That's
for
catchy.
I love this century. Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
So we're continuing our discussion with Gretchen Mortensen, who's assistant business and financial editor and a columnist for The New York Times. We were talking with Gretchen about the markets opened about 20 minutes now and have turned positive in reaction to all of the financial news this morning, including an intervention into the bank sector in the U.K., as well as a coordinated effort to reduce interest rates around the world. Gretchen, thanks for being with us.
Okay.
And, you were talking about this issue of the taxpayers are on the hook. Explain the mechanism on how that actually works. I mean, every year there's a certain amount of obligations in the budget that the Congress doesn't have much discretion on. And those are, debt obligations that we're required to pay, treasury bills, that sort of thing, interest on the national debt, all that sort of thing. If we're suddenly on the hook for more than Congress can cough up in any given fiscal year, what does the government do?
Well, they can always raise money. They have the printing presses and the power of the printing press, which is, you know, an immense power indeed. The kinds of losses that I was talking about really are the losses on the bailout mechanisms that have been put in place. We have an $85 billion loan, for example, to AIG. That's a two-year loan to that company, the largest insurer in the world, to see if they can sell assets at a fair enough price and a good enough price that the taxpayer can be paid back that $85 billion. If they cannot sell for an excess of that amount, then, of course, the losses on that loan will go to the Treasury. That means we absorb them, the taxpayers. Now, also, $700 billion loan, a $700 billion backstop facility that the Congress put in place to try to buy up mortgage securities that are, you know, in disarray and distress. If those mortgage securities are not purchased for a good price and resold at a higher price, then we will also absorb losses on that $700 billion bailout. The other one, of course, is Bear Stearns, which we have, the Fed has backstopped to the degree of $29 billion. And if they cannot get that money back again, it'll be a taxpayer loss. So I'm really talking about the actual money that has been set aside and or already deployed to bail out these companies. And if it is not returned fully, 100%, then those are losses to the taxpayer.
And I guess the markets are just extrapolating out and going, if those loans don't come in, and there are also other obligations in the most latest rescue package, it can be added into the money supply and becomes a direct inflationary problem that is going to lower the value of the dollar.
That's right. They have to keep printing money to make up for these problems, and they need to keep printing money to be able to fund these bailouts. And it really does not look like we're at the end of the bailout line here. It's become an assembly line that just keeps going and going. And, of course, it's now going around the world as well, as you pointed out, in Europe. So this is inflationary. This is why gold is racing today. And, it's just not something that I think Americans want to see, the value of their dollar decline.
I mean, Gretchen, what keeps coming to my mind is like a bottomless pit. These enormous amounts of money that are not only being injected into the banking system, but into companies, not only here in the U.S., but in Europe.
Absolutely true. And this is one of the things that I think puzzles a lot of people who are, you know, not on Wall Street and not working at these firms. And that is how in the world did some, you know, bad mortgages really turn out to be such a massive problem where we're talking about trillions of dollars of losses? Well, the quick answer to that is that the banks who made those loans and or were left with them at the end of the line when the music stopped had borrowed very, very, very massively against them. And so they used borrowed money. And when those assets fell in value, then they had to come up with more collateral. It's leverage on top of risky securities, and it's really a potent, toxic combination.
Yeah, and we haven't even mentioned that the headline in the FT yesterday was banks prepare for credit default swap write-downs and payouts. So that's going to be even more volatility and more toxicity. Gretchen Morgenson, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure.
Gretchen Morgenson is assistant business and financial editor and a columnist for the New York Times.
And, John, we're going to take another quick look at that presidential debate that took place last night between John McCain and Barack Obama in Nashville, Tennessee. It was a town hall-style meeting, and you might recall this question.
Gentlemen, we've come to the last question from Peggy in Amherst, New Hampshire. It has a certain Zen-like quality. I'll give you a fair warning. She says, what don't you know, and how will you learn it?
So, on the line, it's my great pleasure to say that we have Peggy Silva. She is the author of that question. Good morning, Peggy.
Good morning. Thanks for calling.
You're very welcome. Thanks for being on. Tell us about how you came up with that question. Was it a process of elimination, or did it just come to you?
Oh, I've used that question in every presidential campaign since the early 1990s. I live in New Hampshire, and so we are all small towns, and we get to meet the candidates up close and personal every 4 years. And I think it's crucial to try to find a question that truly engages them in a response, a question that doesn't allow for a facile answer, something that they can do by rote, something that they've done hundreds of times that day.
And how did they do last night, though? Did they deliver on what you hoped?
No. I'm definitely a huge Obama fan, and I had asked that question actually of John McCain in 2000 right here in Amherst at our middle school one evening, and he told me that it truly stumped him, and he didn't really have an answer then, nor did he really have one last night. Essential questions lack easy answers, and so it wasn't a surprise that they struggled with it last, or that they didn't take the time to struggle, because it was at the end of a very long long evening.
Well, you nailed them, Peggy. So, you nailed them.
You nailed them. But yeah. Let's listen to a bit of how Obama tried to answer your question.
Absolutely.
My wife, Michelle, is there, and she could give you a much longer list than I do. And most of the time, I learn it by asking her. But look, the nature of the challenges that we're going to face are immense. And one of the things that we know about the presidency is that it's never challenges that you expect. It's the challenges that you don't.
The challenges that he don't expect, and clearly that was a question, Peggy, he wasn't expecting.
That's right.
And so what do you think we learned, if anything, in their trying to answer this very difficult question from the candidates?
I'm not sure that we learned anything, because they are very at ease with knowing that this was a summary question and they had to get their very last statement
They were doing
in.
Their wrap-up. Well, Peggy, are you Zen-like? I mean, Tom Brokaw said you're Zen-like. Are you Zen-like? You don't sound Zen-like to me.
That caused great hysteria at my school this morning because I am the antithesis of the word Zen in my personal life. But it was also interesting that I received about 50 emails last night from students, from former students, and from friends around the country immediately letting me know the power of text messages and Facebook, something I don't even know what that all means necessarily. But it pointed out the fact that John McCain's stating that he is not familiar with the internet puts him at a great disadvantage, because this is the communication tool of this generation, and not to be able to harness it puts him at great risk.
See what you started,
Thank
Peggy.
You.
Thanks
Thank
so
you.
Much for joining us this morning.
Oh, wise
You're
Peggy.
Very welcome. Thanks for the call. My
oh,
students
wise.
Love that you called me.
Peggy Silva coming to us from New Hampshire on how she found herself in the middle of the presidential debate last night.
What did you think of the debate?
The mechanical Abraham Lincoln robot from Epcot Center would keep the attention span of more Americans than this debate could ever do.
Well, that's your takeaway from Politico.com's Fred Barbash with his review of the debate.
And we're also following the global financial crisis. How do you say don't panic?
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We want to hear don't panic in your own words. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.